podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Wales in real trouble here, although they're lucky to get that loose ball. Gibbs with the thrust. Robert Jones, nicely out to Emir Lewis. Emir Lewis is checked it. Up goes Yian Evans. Yian Evans is away. Can the Welsh captain make it? He's going to do it. And it's a try for Wales. And the Welsh captain has scored his 8th and his 33rd
Right, welcome to another edition of the Attacking Scrum podcast. We've had some rugby back this week, which is always helpful when you're doing a rugby podcast. We've also had Wayne Pivak name his squad for the upcoming, or what we believe to be the upcoming Six Nations, which is good. We've had some fantastic listeners' questions, and we've got a return for two. I don't think we've ever done 2 weeks on the spin, or not for a good time, Murph, but good to have you back on the show. How are you?
Good, mate. Yeah, you okay?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you. Not too bad. Yeah, we've had some great feedback from last week. People enjoying having the Murph back on the show. So, yeah,
I think they come for the bits where I get everyone's name wrong.
I think that's it. I think we need to start printing the old bingo cards for Murph calling people Ali Price. And who did we have? Did we have George Earl playing for Saracens last week or something
great
like that?
Great open side. Never as good as Jack Willis, by the way, but still.
Jack Wills, as I like to call him, while we're getting names wrong.
That's a shop, isn't it, Jack Willis?
It is, yeah. No, hang on. It's the other way around, isn't it? Jack Wills is the shop and Jack Willis is the open side flanker. But there we go. Right. I've just finished watching the Ospreys Connacht game, which we were saying off air. You didn't see it, but it was actually quite nice to have a Pro 14 game that was enjoyable. I enjoyed both the games involving the Welsh sides this weekend.
Yeah, a bit of a confession for me. I cancelled in the original lockdown, which was, I don't know, what, 5 years ago now. I cancelled my Premier Sports membership. And I don't know if that's a indictment of the game, but I never went back. So all I see now is the games that S4C get hold of.
But S4C don't cover the Swedish Speedway.
No, all the NHL at 2-3 in the morning when you can't sleep. But still, I haven't deemed that enough to ring them up and go back to them. So,
right, well, there we go. Well, I tell you what, let's start. We'll start then. I guess I'll do a little bit of a report on that one. It's a good win for the Ospreys. They're in good nick. They looked very, very good for most of the game. They dozed off for a little bit towards the end of the first half and kind of got caught napping. And Connacht went in with the lead, despite the Ospreys being very, very dominant. But they came out and blitzed him at the start of the second half, didn't panic. And, you know, the only area of concern really was the scrum. And after they made a few changes, bought on a new front row, it looked brilliant. And they absolutely dominated Connacht in that area. So, yeah, really good win. Rhys Webb, 2 tries, man of the match, the same week he's excluded from the Welsh setup. Yeah, it's, you know, I'm sure we'll get to that.
Murray Kinsella, the journalist from over that way, clipped up one of his passes. One of his passes was so good, he clipped it up as a GIF and posted it on Twitter. That's my only bit of the game I've seen. But it's a bit ironic that he hasn't made the squad for the coming Six Nations. And he's just... one of the reasons is his pace. Pivak's gone public and said his pace and his passing, his service. And then in this clip, which is on Twitter on Murray Kinsella's account, he's thrown a pass which I've never seen the other three. Well, I can't immediately remember the other three scrum are throwing a pass like that. So it's a bit of a riposte, I think, from Rhys Webb.
Yeah, it is a riposte. And I think you've got to come out after you've been left out and make a bit of a statement. And he's certainly done that with a good, array of skills, grabbing 2 tries, sniping, looked bit like the old Webby, really. There was a couple of charge downs in there as well. It wasn't all golden, but he played very well. It's just very, very difficult, because on the flip side, playing devil's advocate, you could say, well, this is exactly what he should have been doing all along, you know. And it's more important that Rhys Webb will now maybe get a run of 4 games, you know, during the Six Nations or whatever, and be able to cement a bit of form and then get back in the side. So, you know, I don't think it's, I don't know. It's tricky because, like we said, for me, he's still in the best three scrum halves in Wales. But yeah. it's going to be no use having him in that Six Nations squad knocking around it as third choice. So, yeah, it is a tricky one. And, like, particularly in the week when the squad gets announced, you will always spend that time kind of judging PVAC selections, because Kieran Hardy came off the bench and didn't have a good time, got yellow carded towards the end of that game. And, you know, it's very, very difficult, because at the same time, it's one game, you know, it's one game in the Pro 14. But it's, yeah, we'll definitely get onto the squad later. But yeah, good win for the Ospreys. And
just going back to the Ospreys a little bit, I remember asking you a question about, because they came back from, I think, 12 points down against Glasgow in the autumn. And I was saying that just couldn't happen last year. So you couldn't imagine it. It turns out, in fairness, Toby Booth and the Ospreys they're obviously much improved. But what I didn't realise at the time is also Glasgow were in a massive hole compared to where they were. So that was probably the actual reason why they came back from 12 points down. Because the thing is, apart from anything else, I mean, Danny Wilson's in charge now, but apart from anything else, they've sold their three best players in the last three seasons.
Yeah.
That's got to catch up with you eventually, haven't it? So,
yeah, it does. But I think it's, you know, it's all relative, because I think if you were to even look at last year's Glasgow team versus last year's Ospreys team, and Ospreys wouldn't have got close to them in any of those games, really. You know, do you know what I mean? If both first teams were out, you'd have to have said that the Ospreys would have struggled to have beaten a first choice Glasgow team. But yeah, that game in the autumn, I think you're right. Glasgow in a bit of a hole, but also there is definitely a change in mentality, and that again was in evidence today, because I think if the Ospreys last season had had a good first half and gone in 17 points, 5 down, they wouldn't have come back after half time and put together a good coherent second half performance. I think, you know, and all that stuff just comes down to coaching. They're well drilled. I don't know what you said at half time, whether it was a bollocking or it was actually you've played well, just go out there and the right things will happen. But whatever, you know, whatever he's done, they're getting good results, and players are putting in good performances. And I think when you see players who've been out of form come back and play well, George North's playing really well at the moment. He looks like, you know, like he's refound a bit of hunger and confidence. So he looked really good. And, you know, Kieran Williams had another outstanding game. There was one blip that led to a try, but, you know, constantly breaking the line, either with a, you know, a little bit of a show and go and brushing players off, or just battering through them. He's, you know, he's looking more and more like a player who's got a very, very bright future ahead of him. So, yeah, I think those games are important, that you can go out and, because there's so many dead rubbers in the league that actually, you know, you can almost afford to lose half these games. But yeah, I was impressed with them. There we go. Right, let's have a quick chat about the game on Friday night as well. So, as you say, you're up to speed with that one. Do you think that Scarlet should have won that game, given all the possession that they had, or is actually that the problem, that if they've got all the possession and didn't look very creative with it?
I don't know if they should have won the game. I mean, it's probably a compliment to Cardiff's defence at the moment.
I think you owe your mate, Mr. Hodges, an apology, because their defence was outstanding.
Well, here's another thing. A lot of people have seen Dai Young's first game in charge, and you know, and they've won and all. But he's literally on a watching brief at the moment. He hasn't done anything with the team. And I know that because I spoke to the academy manager this week. He's literally just overseeing, not doing it. He hasn't changed a thing. Everything. Remember, I was on about last week about what they had done to change their shape to mean that Jared had had such a game last week. Well, I asked nothing.
Yeah,
they didn't change anything. You just sometimes it's just the old coaches out the way and the new coaches come in, and everything just sharpens up and everyone's, you know, in sharper focus. And that's what happened. So he's had two good games back to back now, Jared, and straight in the Welsh team. Although I've just been reading. I thought I'd better be up to the minute if I was coming on again. And turns out Wayne Pivac inquired if he could have Reece Priestland.
Yeah, well, this is. I don't know, right? This is a bit of a strange one. We'll come back to the Cardiff game in a sec.
Yeah, I keep getting ahead of myself on the Welsh squad.
Sorry, we'll come on to the Welsh squad in a bit. Let's stick with Cardiff for the time being. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, Dai Young, obviously, it's very easy to draw the. to draw the line and say, right, well, you know, he's in charge now. But you're right, you never have a chance to make that much of an impact when you're coming in and taking a side over. And you know, for that game, he was still halfway down the M4 10 minutes into it. So I don't think
It's a lovely welcome back to Wales, Alex. Getting used to our road infrastructure again. It's not quite Coventry, is it?
I know, and in the middle of lockdown as well. But yeah, so you know, I don't think that's right. But he'll be impressed with what he's seen, which I think is the good thing. There were lots of good individual performances within there again. I thought, yeah, halfbacks were bright again. Ray Lilo, as good a game as he's had for a year or two. I think he's so important to them, not just in attack, but defensively. And again, a bit worrying for Wales that, you know, John Fox has been skinned a few times in these two games against Cardiff.
Yeah, it seems to be like a soft inside shoulder. He's drifting across and gets cut inside. He's obviously not going to keep falling for that. You know, he's a British Lion after all. But it's 7-2 games running where they just find an easy way out. Is it just cutting on his inside shoulder? So I can't really explain that one because it's happened three times over the last two matches.
And they're the things you'd normally, if it was going into, you know, if you were going into a Gatland Edwards camp, you'd be relatively happy that they're lying those things out when they get, you know, when they get the players for a fortnight before the Six Nations. But obviously defence has been a massive problem under Pivac. So, you know, not necessarily sure that's going to be quite a straightforward, but yeah, you know, he's still not played a huge amount of rugby, and you know, he's getting back up to speed. But
he was rushed. I don't know if you covered it on here, but he was rushed back in the autumn, definitely.
Oh, for sure.
Much too soon for him, and too soon for the team as well.
Yeah, and again, this is definitely a recurring theme that we're going to come back to. And I tell you what, the other thing that struck me with the Cardiff game, I thought that both sides had kind of, to a certain degree, had makeshift packs. You know, I think the Scarlets back row lacked a proper open side in there after what we were saying last week about them having lots of sevens. I think they missed that because Kennedy, I don't think, is a, you know, he's a very good, useful squad player, but I don't think he's an out-and-out fetcher of a seven. And I think they kind of missed that at the breakdown. They went for a very big pack, hoping to smash their way over the gain line. And really, they didn't look like doing it, you know, not just in the backs, but they didn't look like doing it in the forwards either.
And conversely, James Botham ended up as a genuine open side, I guess, ended up as man of the match. There's another two fingers to Pivac as well.
You know what? And I think he could have been man of the match in the fixture a fortnight ago as well. Who got it? I can't remember who got it.
Jared.
Yeah, Jared got it. And, you know, obviously very eye-catching, but, you know, Jim Botham had another outstanding game there as well. So, I don't know. It's a bit strange. I'm still not sure he's a complete out and out seven myself. Actually, James Botham. I think he's a six and a half. But with a Tipperick or a Navidi or someone alongside him, I think he's got all the ability to be an international back row forward. I just think it's the chopping and changing. We're desperate to talk about this Wales squad, aren't we? Everything we keep.
No. Well, what we could do before we get that far is cover the controversy over the Callum Mahoney knockout.
Well, yeah, we should talk about that. That was a red card, wasn't it? I think in this day and age it is.
Well, if it's zero tolerance over anyone getting knocked out, then I suppose it is. But like, it's not as if Ahip's arm came far away from his body.
No.
Like, you could... First of all, we have to say this has been all over Twitter and it's like entrenched whether you think it's red or not and all this. What you can't judge this incident on is a freeze frame posted on someone's...
No, you can't. Yeah, exactly. You
can't judge it on slow motion either. I mean, I know the TMO will look at it in slow motion, but if you watch it at full speed, it doesn't look like there's any movement towards Callum Mahoney's head other than... By Dimitri's arm, other than Callum Mahoney putting his arm on the wrong side and catching an elbow. That's what it looks like at full speed.
Yeah.
Slow it down, then you know, because Ahip's arm elbow kind of comes out as a kind of a push away kind of thing, or whether that's, you could call that a push away or a jab, I don't know. But like, what I'm getting at is Ahip's, in the past, they've had penalties given where players are carrying the ball with an elbow out in front of them and their forearm out in front of them. Well, his arm is against his body. So, you know, if someone comes flying into you with their head and your arm is alongside your body, really, really dodgy ground to get onto, because then every time anyone gets their head in the wrong place and gets knocked out, that player's off the pitch.
Yeah, which, you know, I think, but we've seen that kind of happen. There's stuff that you'll watch back from last year's World Cup that would have been red cards. And now we'd look at them and go, well, that's clear cut, easy red cards. At the time, and what we were used to seeing beforehand was there's no intent there, that, you know, he's just gone for a big hit and he's ridden up. And actually, I think we've got to a position where with most high tackles that you can kind of say, look, if you hit someone in the shoulder with your shoulder in their head, it's a red card, unless there's a massive mitigating factor. And we've just kind of got to that position where that's what the rule is now.
Yeah, but that's for the tackler, not the ball carrier.
No, that's right. That's true. And what I'm saying is, I think we're going to get to that position with the ball carrier as well. Again, I need to see the incident again. But at the time, I looked at it and thought he's in trouble here. And it's kind of, there's almost like a bit of the second swing, or like the jab that you said. That's the bit that I think is the concerning bit. I'm surprised they didn't look at it properly, given the fact that he was stone cold out.
Yeah,
that's the bit I was a bit surprised by.
Yeah, I suppose they could have looked at it, but I don't know. Like even when, say they looked at it and decided there was movement from your arm, which caused the main issue from Callum Mahoney is his head is on the wrong side, and therefore he traps his own head against his own shoulder. We're doing a visual display to each other here, which doesn't come across obviously, but because his head's on the wrong side, he's kind of then jammed his head between Dimitri and his own shoulder.
Yeah,
if that makes any sense. And so, like, if he tackled with his left shoulder instead of his right shoulder, he wouldn't have been knocked out. And then, I know you're not supposed to put the onus in that regard, but if you get yourself in a tangle at any level of rugby, really, you get your head in the
wrong. You're going to get hurt. Yeah,
you're going to damage yourself. So, and what makes it more difficult is they're playing at very high speed, high intensity, so that these things will happen. But I don't know. I definitely wouldn't. Say if you persuaded me, right, that he was in the wrong, I still wouldn't want it to be red.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
The ultimate problem was caused by poor tackle technique.
Yeah.
Not by someone running with their elbow up trying to take someone's head off.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you decided there was guilt on the part of Ahip, and I'm sure there's a lot of West Walians shouting at me down their podcast phone or whatever they're listening on. But unless you can, if you could persuade me that he wasn't wrong, I definitely would. I would want it to be yellow at the most.
Yeah, look, I get that. I get that completely. And I think that, you know, whatever we call them, these rugby collisions, that there's certainly no intent or recklessness in. But he does carry a bit like that, Ahit. There's a bit of a swinging arm push-off thing that I think has a tendency to get him in trouble. But I know what you mean. And I think ultimately, it does come down to misjudging the tackle technique. And also,
I'll tell you what doesn't help is Jim Botham, James Botham, whatever you want to call him, congratulating him afterwards.
Yeah.
He goes up and butts him, like, go on. That did not help, you know, from an optics point of view. That was not a good look. You can't blame Dimitri for that, because all he's done is essentially stand his ground in a tackle, you know. But then James Bolton goes, go on, my son. That didn't help. I mean, in court, that would look bad.
Oh, yeah, particularly while you're doing it over Callum Mahoney, who's out cold, out for the count at that point in time.
Yeah, no, that wasn't clever at all, man.
No, it wasn't. But yeah, it was a good, interesting game of rugby. And you know, as you say, they're often at a premium in the Pro 14. So yeah, it's good. But I'm going to take this listener's question now, because it obviously ties in with what we're just discussing. This one's from Gareth Cripps. Scarlets had 12 internationals in their starting team against the Blues. So why did they look so blunt in attack? Is it down to coaching?
It's kind of a repeat of what we were saying earlier about they had a lot of possession and didn't manage to make any ground. So I'd have to say again, the Blues defence is going well at the moment. Maybe Dan Jones is not enough for him in that regard. He's a steady kind of kicking type player. Mm. One of the worries is, on top of that, from not just Scala's point of view, is Johnny Williams and Fox are probably going to be the first choice.
Well, they are, and they're going to be 12 and 13 against Ireland for sure.
Difference being they'll have Dan Biggar that's feeding them the ball and not Dan Jones. Not that I'm, you know, dissing Dan Jones, but
I think it's a game plan thing, isn't it? As much as, you know, it's game plan, which ultimately will come down from coaches, but they're obviously trying to play this power game. You know, you can tell by the size that every week they go out with this monstrous great pack. And then that's, you know, and that's fine. You know, sometimes it will work. Sometimes it will get you the front football. But I think when it's not working, as it obviously wasn't on Friday night, there needs to be something in there to be able to mix it up. And, you know, it looked, for all that possession that they had and all the penalties they kept getting, you had, you know, you had a driving line out, the ball had come out the back, and then they might go through a few phases and they're not kind of getting anywhere. And then Dan Jones will kick wide. And that happened like two or three times in crucial parts of the game. And again, that's not just down to Dan Jones, but it's down to the fact that who's calling the shots for adding a bit of variety in there. And it just wasn't coming. They didn't look like, you know, breaking down that defence throughout large chunks of the game. So, yeah, I don't know, this whole kind of just trying to out-muscle the opposition, I think it's a bit odd considering how they've played for a very long time. You know, it's great having that additional power, but I think you've also got to be a lot smarter and play what's in front of you.
It's a good point, actually, because they weren't having that issue under the last coach, were they?
No. Well, no.
Everything seemed to be flowing together nicely under him. And so, I mean, you could make excuses for, what's his name? Is it Delaney, the new guy? You could make excuses for him because the season is very disjointed and, you know, it's easy to lose that kind of cohesion, but other teams are managing, so you can't really use that too much of an excuse, but they're definitely not as well drilled or not drilled. They're definitely not as cohesive under this guy as they were under Brad.
Yeah, I think you're right. But, you know, again, you know, Brad Moore didn't have a particularly good first half of his season in charge, and it kind of all started to come together towards the end. Yeah. And so, you know, I do think you have to give, you've got to give kind of coaches time, but they've definitely got the strongest squad out of the Welsh regions. And you would have to say at the moment, certainly in the league, they're underperforming. But then, you know, they went and had that big win a big win away at Bath in the Heineken Cup.
Got a win.
So it's hard because that's the thing that's destroyed. Everyone would forget about the Pro 14 form if they were you know, going on a European Cup run. But
that was one of my favourite games of the season. I somehow amongst everything that's going on, like the world falling apart and everything else, I'd forgotten about that match. I'd loved that match. I was raving about it. They only got to get to a certain percentage of that form and they'd be fine.
Yeah, I think that's it. I don't know. The concern for me, if I were a Scarlet,
maybe they just called Cardiff at a bad time.
Possibly, but yeah, they
played them when Mulvihill was still here. Yeah. They probably would have been quite comfortable.
Yeah, possibly. I don't know. Again, I think this Mulvihill thing is slightly tricky because I do think.
Oh yeah, no, I don't totally blame Mulvihill at all.
No, I don't. But it's they've been pretty. They've looked pretty underwhelming in both those games against Cardiff in the space of a fortnight. So I think there's got to be a few changes within there. They're missing Priestland without a doubt, but you're going to have to start to
Patchell. Priestland on the mind, you are.
Patchell, I'm catching your disease of getting the name.
I don't know if you can catch early onset dementia over Zoom.
If ever there was a time in the world that you could, it'd be right now. They're definitely missing Patchell. But you've got a plan for that. You know, when you're recruiting in the summer, you've got a plan for the fact that he's injury prone. He's been out for a very long period of time. And you've got to have a plan B, because when like we were saying about Ireland and Sexton over the last 10, 15 years, that they've not had anyone in there to kind of help run that game plan for them. Well, it's kind of the same at the Scarlets. You know, they don't really have that running 10 option unless you're putting Costello in there. And obviously he doesn't feel confident enough doing that at the moment. I mean, did he even get off the bench on Friday? I can't remember now, but
I don't remember him coming
on. No, Angus O'Brien came on, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Fullback, but Yeah, I think they're going to have to look at having a bit of a plan B, because if this Muslin game doesn't go well, then you know, then you've got to figure out other ways of winning games.
Who did you say they got next then?
They've got Leinster next week. I think it's the only Pro 14 game. It is in Llanelli, I think, if memory serves me correctly. But yeah, I mean, it, you know, it could be bloody Leinster under 20s and you wouldn't fancy it, would you?
No. Am I right in thinking Sexton limped off in the Munster match yesterday?
Don't know, couldn't tell you. Didn't see it, actually. But yeah,
I think they just need to... I know he's captain of the national team, but I think they just need to move on. Because he's... Even if he gets rolled up for the Six Nations and plays brilliantly well and everything else, he's still going to be 37 in the next World Cup. Or more. Something ridiculously old.
That's the thing I found so strange about straight after the World Cup, picking him as captain. It didn't make any sense to me. They seem to have had a bit of a problem with captains post O'Connell, really. Do you remember there was that brief period in time where Rory Best kind of had it by default because the players said, you know, they had like a players vote or something, and right. Best got it, and then it was someone, you know, maybe it's Heaslip for a bit, and then Best got it again, and then again, it just like picking Sexton age 35, just, you know, or 34 or whatever he was after the World Cup. It just all seemed a bit strange when you become reliant on one player. You're saying, well, you know, he's the first name on the team sheet. We're going to try and carry on playing in this way. But yeah, it's odd. But yeah, we'll see, you know, we'll see what that holds in store during the Six Nations, I guess, providing he is fit. Right, we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to get back after that and we're going to talk about the Wales squad, because it's... We've been skirting around the issue very, very badly for this first half. So
we tried to ignore it as best we could.
Yeah, we've been lying offside in a pretty offside position for the whole of this first half. But let's take this quick break and then we'll get right to it. Right, the leash is off now, Murph. Time to talk about the squad that Wayne Pivak has named for the upcoming Six Nations. I'm just going to give a quick recap for anyone who has missed it, or I'm not going to lie, it's a recap for my own benefit. But the squad is as follows. So, loosehead props, Reece Carey, Wynne Jones, Rodri Jones. Hookers, Elliot D, Ryan Elias, Ken Owens. Tighthead props, Leon Brown, Thomas Francis. And then you've got, Dylan Lewis in there as well. Then you've got Jake Ball, Adam Beard, Alan Wynne-Jones, Corey Hill, Will Rowlands in the second row. And the back rowing options of Dan Lydiot, Josh Navidi, Aaron Wainwright, Toby Faletau, Josh McLeod, Justin Tipperick. And then in the backs, Gareth Davis, Thomas Williams, Kieran Hardy as scrum halves, Dan Bigger, Callum Sheedy, Jared Evans, fly halves, Johnny Williams, Jonathan Davis, Nick Tompkins, Owen Watkin in the centre, George North, Josh Adams, Hallam Amos, Lewis Rees-Sammet, Lee Halfpenny and Liam Williams as the outside backs. I guess immediate surprises. Who stood out on that as someone you weren't expecting to see in there, Murph?
Well, even though you told me it was going to happen last week, I was still surprised to see Dan Lydiot get picked. Obviously Reece Webb to not be picked. Like the Reece Webb situation, you could put it like I just covered now, Johnny Sexton, you could put it down to his age, because 2023 he's going to be 35 or something in that region, and that's all for a scrum half, even a really good one. But then you, even if you made that excuse, then you pick a 33-year-old Dan Lydiot.
Yeah, well, and you also say that you're looking at Reece Priestland as a 34-year-old outside half as well. Yeah. So I mean,
you could pass off Reece Priestland as just an injury crisis. You know,
is there an injury crisis at 10? Like, I look at those three 10s and wouldn't say that's a crisis. I mean, like, you know, it's okay. So Patchell's missing, obviously.
And Anscombe. But
Anscombe has been out for so long. But these are
I think it tells you what he... Well, you can read between the lines and draw conclusions about what he thinks about Jared Evans.
I think you can. Which is interesting, because he's massively improved. You'd think my thoughts would be, I've got Look, if Dan Bigger was injured, I would say, yeah, okay, it's an injury crisis. I need an old head who can manage a game into lots of international experience and is playing well, and Priestland fits that bill. But when you've got Bigger fit, and then you've got Sheedy, you know, who's an up and coming, you know, in form 10 playing in England, I think you want a Jack in the box option as your third 10 in there. You know, particularly if things are going completely tits up and you're two scores down, being able to bring him off the bench and just go and play. It doesn't matter about everything else. I just need you to pull something out of the bag. Mm. That to me, you know, should be a more appealing option than, you know, as good as Priestland is. And, you know, he's obviously got the backs firing in the past, and, you know, he's not played international rugby for a long time. You know, he had like one cap against Georgia about 3 years ago. And I don't know. I'm not quite sure I understand all this clamoring for Reece Priestland, age 34. You know, I would get it more if Bigger was injured. But at the moment, I'd be much more excited about the potential Jared Evans has.
Yeah, I'm a little bit surprised that Priestland hasn't gone to Japan.
Mm.
I imagine he'd make more money there than coming to the Blues. This week, it just dawned on me this week, I think Owen Williams is in Japan, isn't he?
He certainly signed over there. Whether he's actually managed to get out, I don't know. But
quite a few seasons, I always thought he'd be a good fit at the Dragons, Owen Williams.
Yeah.
He just doesn't seem interested in coming back to Wales.
I don't know quite what all that, you know, there was a big clambering for him, wasn't there, for a while. And then he got in the side in...
He played him at 12, I think.
Didn't he played him at 12 in about 2017. And he was... Everyone seemed to rave about him. And I thought he was solid without being spectacular. And I think he's a really good player. I like him a lot. But... yeah, I don't know. He's never been, you know, because he left the Scarlets because he wasn't getting enough first team action. Where did he go first? Leicester?
Yeah.
Leicester, then Gloucester. You know, he could have come back at either of those and then hasn't come back this time round. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, maybe he just doesn't feel like he's going to get close to the side, and therefore, you know, it's a short career. Get out there and earn some big bucks.
Yeah, but if he was still knocking around the... Well, I don't know if it would work that way, but if he was still knocking on the Gloucester squad, he could have had a call up.
Yeah, without getting into the technicalities of it, I don't. Could he have? Don't know. Not if he'd have signed an extension. But I mean, either way, like he could very easily have. You know,
I'm not even sure how old he is now, but he must be pushing 30 anyway. So
I'd have thought he's late 20s. Yeah. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's a bit of a strange one. The halfback scenario. To go on to Dan Lydiate, you know, I know we covered this a little bit last week and tied into the Priestland thing. I think there's a lot made about age. But I think what I find quite strange is that over the autumn, he picked consistently, was looking at Shane Lewis-Hughes, although he wasn't in his first choice squad. You know, he got plenty of game time there. As we said, or we remembered after the podcast, Aaron Wainwright got a bit of game time there as well.
I know Aaron's dad, as you know.
I know, yeah.
He completely forgot he existed.
But he did play eight as well, didn't he? He had a game at eight against Georgia. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There must be something that he's not quite sold on what he's seen from Shane Lewis-Hughes in order to go back to Lydia, who's playing really, really well. And he had another excellent game today.
Well, this is the issue. Like, even if Dan Lydiate is in his form of his life, it's still questionable. There's still questionable whether you, because as we know, everything is on a World Cup cycle now. Hmm. It's still questionable whether you should pick him, even if he's playing, you know, like a 25-year-old Dan Lydiate. So I don't, when he was, you know, Lion and all the other things, all the other accolades he's garnered, and you know, there's exemptions when it comes to things like that. Like Alan Wynne-Jones, it doesn't matter if he's 55, you'd still pick him because it's the leadership and he's the talisman and all the other things. But Dan Lydiate hasn't been in the team for three seasons. And then if you think Shane Lewis-Hughes is too soon for him international level and you want him to, you know, mature in the Blues team, that's fine. And then possibly, if once you made that decision, then maybe there's not that many fit back blindsides, you know, obviously Ross Moriarty is, if he's fit, then Dan Lydiate doesn't get picked. But like, what would happen, say if Ollie Griffiths was fit for a change.
Yeah.
And he picked Dan Idiot.
I don't think he would have, to be honest. I think that it's... I tell you, the main thing, looking at this whole squad, right, the picture it tells me is that he needs results above everything. Exactly. And he does, and he does. He is a guy who's got a break clause in his contract and has had a really bad start as international coach. And it tells me that, you know, there's no room, you know, while we're all thinking in terms of World Cup cycles, he's thinking of, I need to get myself to the World Cup. And
And in his defence, it's a smaller squad this time than in the autumn because they're only playing four matches spread out over a longer period rather than four in a month or five in a month or whatever they ended up playing. So you needed a bigger squad in the autumn, so there's going to be more youngsters in there. But, it, you know, he seems to have ditched a lot, like Johan Lloyd is no longer involved, which I don't disagree with. I think it probably was too soon with him. But it seems to be... like you say, it does seem to be like, how am I going to get some results in this tournament?
The ones on there that stood out for me, right? Ken Owens hadn't played a game all season until Friday night. Josh Navidi hadn't played a game all season till Friday night. Alan Wynne-Jones hasn't played a game since going off injured in the autumn.
Yeah,
To a certain degree, Dan Lydiate, because you need, you know, proven international player. Well, I'm sure there was someone else in there that stuck out as well. Oh yeah, the fact that he had approached Priestland. All of that to me just smacked. If you had Jake Ball again, you know, he'd been injured and kind of come straight back in. All of this,
and we know Jake Ball is definitely not going to be at the next World Cup.
He's definitely not going to be in the next World Cup. He's not going to be in the summer. You know, it's
yeah, you can't even tour.
all of which to me is, I need the best players, regardless of their, you know, regardless of their fitness. I'm just going to have to get them in the squad and hope for the best. And that, I don't know, that's obviously a worrying sign. But, you know, if you have a two-year contract, pressure, you know, that's going to put the pressure on. And that can't help with when you're trying to manage a dressing room.
I don't know if the two-year contract is putting on as much pressure as the fact that you're losing and playing awful.
But
if he'd been going well up till now, the contract would enter his mind because he'd fancy himself to have an extension and all that. Because they look like, a lot of them look like this is one of my favorite sayings when teams are going badly, a lot of them look like they've never met before. You know, you've got a really expensive coach, this one and the next one, whatever they get paid, I don't care. The last one, they all make a lot of money, and your players go out on the pitch looking like strangers, which always. Especially, I mean, at any level, I suppose it's bad, but at international level, when you're really high-level players and they don't look like they've played together before. So that's why, one of the weird ones in the autumn was when Josh McLeod was picked and then got injured. I know, again, it's a case of who was fit and who was still standing, but he then went to, after Josh McLeod was ruled out, he then went to the second choice, Slattery, open side, who was James Davies, maybe. And like, I think everyone in rugby, even non-Welsh people, are fans of James Davies because of the way he plays. But because he's so small, he needs to be playing at his absolute best form if he's going to play international rugby. And he wasn't. I don't think he'd even have many games to let you at that stage. And when he played against Scotland, he looked so, I thought he looked so out. I mean, he was up against someone, he was up against Hamish Watson, which is not pleasant for anyone.
That back row of Richie and Watson playing together, and they're a pair of wild dogs. Those two, they're absolute animals, and
really annoying for opposing fans.
They got dick faces as well. You know, like but again, they're players you would absolutely love to have in your, you know, to have in your team. The other thing as well is, when McLeod got injured, he was replaced by Shane Lewis Hughes in the overall squad, who went straight into number six. Straight into the number six shirt. None of it made sense. Lloyd Williams went from not being in the squad to then being on the bench to then starting. You know, all of it, none of this made sense. It was like, you know, Kieran Hardy was in that squad as third choice. And then when they had a couple of injury problems, they went to Lloyd, who came in. It's all very, very confused. And
yeah, that was the one I was going to bring up in relation to Rhys Webb earlier, is Lloyd Williams finished the tournament as starting nine. I know it was injuries, but still. So...
But it's that yeah. thing of how someone can be parachuted from outside the squad straight into match day 23. Yeah. That's the thing that I think is really, really confusing. And, you know, I say it a million times, international rugby coaches are judged on selection because you get so little time with the players. You know, like you said.
Also, you get so much analysis of your selections by looms like us.
You do. And obviously, I'm fairly certain that, you know, the analysis from looms like us is low down on the list of Wayne Pinnock.
Least of his worries. Yeah. At the same time, if he'd have had these issues last Six Nations in his first few selections, fine. But he is 12 months in.
Yeah.
And had a look at a lot of people by now.
Well, I think, yeah. And look, scrum half is the one that I keep coming back to because he picked like six or seven scrum halves during that time. And none of them, you know, he never picks the same one on the bounce. And yes, there will be injuries and stuff, but I don't know, this Six Nations, I think he's got to pick one. And that, you know, again, it can't help bigger at 10. It can't help the pack having the constant chopping and changing at such a pivotal position. He's got to find one. I think from the outset, he's got to give someone three games on it in the row.
Here's a little kicker for you. If you wanted to really help Dan Bigger at 10, you'd pick Reece Webb at 9.
Yeah, you probably would.
Who's he ever played more rugby with than Reece Webb?
Yeah, well, no one. I don't know. The whole thing is just so strange. The whole Webb thing is just so strange. I don't know why you'd pick him, have him in the squad and floating around as your third choice. You know, this decision makes more sense to me, having him not in the squad, than it did having him in there and not really featuring him.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I think you know that if he's not playing well enough, and they said that in the autumn and gone, look, you need to play some rugby, go and play that, and then let's review this in the Six Nations. That would make much more sense to me than it happening now.
Well, the other way it could have been is if he was in the squad as third choice and they just said to him, listen, we want to have a look at the other two, but you're the experienced player and we're just going to keep you on the back burner until such a time, you know? But that obviously didn't happen if you're just in the third choice.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That's the one he's absolutely got to get right. He's got to pick, you know, he's got to pick a 9 and stick with him now, I think, because it's, it's getting,
And who should that 9 be, though?
For me, I think it's, I think it's Thomas Williams.
Me too.
I think it's quick service is a threat. You know, we've offered, you know, if you want to go and try and play the overall, I know I'm not a fan of the whole kind of box kicking thing, but that is the kind of the way that a lot of it's played. But I think probably, you know, Italy would be the only side who don't play that game better than us. All the other sides will be able to control a game better than we will. So you've got to try something a bit different. And I think having a 9 who offers a threat and some quicker service can only be a good thing, really. So that would be my thought process behind it.
Well, they're picked in pairs now, aren't they? Because the second 9 always comes on after about an hour. So it's just a case of which one is going to, you're picking two and which one is going to be the regular starter. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's any kick, to me, it's any combination of Thomas and Gareth.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. But again, like, I'd like to see one of them get the nod.
Yeah,
for a couple of games, and get given the opportunity to kind of impose themselves. And again, in a way, both of them, kind of at international level. Oh, this is probably a bit harsh on Gareth Davis, but I don't know. He always looks so dangerous coming off the bench when the game starts to break up because of his intercepts, because of his ability to find his way to the try line, and I think Thomas does the same thing because he's quick, he's pacey, he wants the game when it's a bit more broken up, and. Yeah, it's tricky. It's a real tricky one. But for me, I think Thomas Williams is the most informed of the nines, and I think he's the one who's got the most opportunity to improve. So realistically, I think he's the one who, if you were looking at 2023 and saying he's going to be our starting 9, it's probably Thomas Williams, and therefore you need to get him up to the level to being international level, and I think that starts now. But
yeah, I think he got the better of Gareth Davis on Friday night.
I think he did, yeah.
And also, going back to last week's conversation and the Lions again, if depending on what happens to Wales, Like if it goes well, then we might have two scrum halves on the Lions tour.
Yeah.
And if it goes really badly, we might end up with none, I guess. But at the moment, like Conor Murray's struggling to keep his place in the Irish side.
Yeah.
So then you got my mate Ali Price, north of the border. Or Tommy Price, I called him.
Like, it was Tommy, yeah.
Yeah. And then it was just like some bloke down the pub, I know, Tommy Price. And you could end up with Ben Youngs as the test starter in the Lions.
I said this before. I don't think
Conor Murray is on his kind of downward trajectory. And
honestly, I could still see a position where Reece Webb's in that 23.
Good point.
Because you know Gatlin knows him and likes him and trusts him. I don't know whether the relationship was soured over the whole Toulon affair or not. But I can't imagine any of that was really Gatlin's thinking. You know, again, I think he might look at him and think, I know what Reece Webb's capable of. I'm going to have him for a 6-week tour. I know I can get him up to speed. And look, I bang on about this all the time, but all the players playing their best rugby, Murray and Webb are well ahead of all those others for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, whether or not Murray has the ability to come back up, and you know, his kind of star is in decline. Same could be said for Webb, but you know, their best. You know, Ben Youngs is a. I don't know. This is really harsh, but will there ever be a more average England player to get 100 caps? I doubt it. Like, you know, he's neat and tidy. His kicking's good, and he invariably pulls out a blinder against Wales once every 2 years. But But behind that pack, you should be bossing the show.
Exactly. He can be right off. Like, he has moments where he looks like he's untouchable sometimes, but then he doesn't. He never sustains that. And he has periods where the team are carrying him. You know what I mean? So I'm pretty sure any international quality scrum half had come through in England in the last few years would have pushed him off the side.
Yeah.
They haven't produced any. Although, hot topic, Harry Randall's just been picked in their squad. So
yeah, he has. And again, we've covered this quite a lot. I think that he's good enough to play for England or Wales. I think he wanted to play for England all along. And
yeah, he's English. Yeah, it just happened. He lived here for a bit.
Yeah.
I don't see it. There's no. Now that I know what I didn't know all the details of his case, but he's born in England to English parents, lived here for about less than 10 years, I think.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, between the ages of 7 and 16 or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
He probably had Welsh scrum half magic dust sprinkled on him some point in his... while he was here.
There is no doubt that's where he gets the skill from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they just don't produce any. They don't... Even like some of their great... They would consider great scrum halves, like Dowie Morris, as they call him over there. And Matt Dawson's, I've said this hundreds of times, but Matt Dawson's whole Lions career is reliant on Rob Howley's dodgy shoulder.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have played any Lions tests.
And so,
you know, it's just a position they don't churn out, whereas they do churn out players in other positions, you know. You just don't seem to churn out scrum arse. And maybe it was Harry Randall's very brief time. I don't know how brief he was. In Wales, is where he's just picked up the magic.
He would have played a lot of rugby. You know, a lot of his rugby education would have started in Wales. So yeah, look, that's definitely the case. That's definitely what we're saying. Yeah.
We can just put that to bed.
This is all leading to a Ben Youngs hat trick against Wales in the Six Nations now, isn't it? It definitely is.
And then Harry Randall coming off the bench.
Grabbing two. Yeah, it feels like it's heading that way. Right, let's take a couple of listeners' questions to finish then, Murph, because I know you've got an evening of NFL to enjoy.
Yeah,
I'm going to watch the Swedish Speedway on Premier Sports. So this one is from the Dragon Thistle Rugby Pod, which again you might want to tap them up for a bit of work as well, Murph, while you're doing the rounds. Pivac's had a lot of criticism, but when you see the play coming from the regions over Christmas, you can understand where some of the poor play comes from. How does he change this for the Six Nations?
I'm not sure the premise of the questions. Are they blaming the standard regional play for the fact that Pivac can't coach the Welsh team?
Yes.
Right, okay. I mean, the derbies have always, like under Gatland and before him Gareth Jenkins, and before him Steve Hansen, all the Derby games have predominantly been shite anyway.
Yeah,
it's just like a load of, I don't know, individual battles, and the whole game doesn't really ever get going, or very rarely does. I mean, I think one of them might have been, I can't remember now. It seems like 3 weeks ago. It seems like a long time ago, but one of them out of the Derbies might have been quite a good game. But normally it's lashing down, you know. And the most exciting thing is that everyone in the crowd is drunk.
Yeah,
you know, it's never been about the quality of the match, and that didn't stop Gatland from transferring a decent side onto the pitch at international level. So obviously there's issues across the whole of the regions with being able to compete in terms of salary budgets and what have you, but that's nothing new either. So, you know, I mean, the probably the best counter argument to that question is Caletti beating Bath away a couple of weeks ago, back in December, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we've said this a couple of times. I can't remember if it was last week I said it with you, but I always use it as a bit of a horse racing analogy, because, you know, you sometimes when you're watching the regional rugby, you're looking for the winner of the Gold Cup on a Tuesday on a Tuesday at Foss Lass, right? And it's and that's a very
heavy going,
yeah, you know. And that's not always the case. Really, the places you want to be looking for those pedigree players is Heineken Cup level, and ideally in the latter stages of those. So it is very, very tricky. But yeah, like you say, what Gatland was always able to do was turn it into a pretty formidable squad. So yeah, you know, that's the challenge of being Wales coach, is you've got to be able to take them. I think the players are out there. Like, you can't tell me that looking at those squads it's a side that shouldn't be competing with the other Six Nations squads. It's, as you said on last week's show, it's basically the same squad that went to that was within a whisker of getting to the World Cup final.
Yeah, well, no one's retired since the World Cup. We've had it. I mean, we went into the tournament minus Ellis Jenkins and Gareth Anscombe, but everyone who was at the World Cup is still available now, barring, you know, like Rhys Patchell being injured or whatever.
Well, and Toby's back.
Sorry,
and Toby's back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's no, you know, it's something that came up before when we were talking about, you know, like the fourth autumn international, when Gatland would make 23 changes to the match day squad. And then we would always struggle to beat someone like Georgia or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And quite often people would blame that on a lack of depth in the Welsh rugby and all this. But even if you haven't got the quality of player on the pitch, and I'm going to say, this is not just repeat myself, this is something I said about 5 minutes ago, there's no excuse for being complete strangers on the pitch when you're professionals, coached by a highly paid professional, to go on the pitch not knowing what the fucking hell you're doing or who the guy next to you is. That is not acceptable. Even if you're not the best, you know, even if you're not going to go on the British lot to be a British Lion or whatever, what else you might achieve, you still need to be able to work as a team with other players on the pitch. That is, you know, whether you can actually beat five men and score a try is a different matter to actually knowing what the hell you're doing, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, look, I think you're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head there. Let's finish on this one, which is, I don't know if you've seen this this week, Murph, but David Buttress made a few comments on a football podcast, of all things, a Newport County podcast, about having three teams playing at Rodney Parade and how it doesn't work, and seemed to essentially suggest that the reason it doesn't work is because of Newport RFC, which is an interesting one because they haven't played a game there for a year. And the pitch is knackered. But I think, yeah, this strange, acrimonious relationship between Newport RFC and the Dragons, and in specifically with regards to Rodney Parade, is something that's going to need to be addressed at some point, as is the pitch, right? I think, again, I don't know if you've seen this article that's doing the rounds, but yeah, he's kind of gone on a football podcast and said that it's not sustainable having three teams playing there as it is.
I thought they relayed.
It was about 3 years ago that it got.
It looked amazing.
And it looked amazing for ages.
Now there's hardly any sport on it. Now it's terrible.
Yeah. but I mean, this is what happens when you have a grass pitch next to the Usk. And then you've had, you know, I suppose obviously Cardiff have been playing a few games there as well. So you're having a few games of pro rugby there.
Yeah, that would happen.
But, you know, it's not as many as would have been happening if the Black and Ambers have been playing. But I mean, look, this is something they just got to sort out. They've got to find a position. For me, right, they need to sell the club. To get a private investor to buy the club back from the union, to shut all this whinging, weird hybrid situation. You can't have one of the regions owned by the union and the rest owned privately. It just doesn't work. You either need all in or one, and you're not going to have the union owning all of those regions at the moment. So I think realistically they need to get back to that situation where they're controlling their own destiny. Secondly, if you do that, you then need a pitch that is capable of having all three teams on there. You know, I think the county arrangement works financially for them because they're getting regular revenue coming in off it. But then you need a pitch that's good enough to do it. I don't fully understand the financial situation with what the Black and Ambers pay. Butchers has said a few times that they pay a pittance in order to get access to that. But at the same time, you know, all the members of those clubs voted in favour of the union taking over in order for the Dragons to survive. But I think we just reached a stage where we've got to kind of draw a line in the sand of this now. First thing they've got to do as soon as and hopefully that sand isn't on the pitch, but the first thing they've got to do when private investment comes in is get a pitch that's good enough. And if that's the situation with Newport RFC that they get it at a very preferable rate, and that's the thank you for essentially allowing the Dragons to survive, then fine, but you've got to move on. Because it is now a position where, you know, this whole situation in Wales where you've got amateur clubs and professional rugby, it doesn't work. Like, it's not, the amateur clubs are not realistically going to provide players for professional rugby, not by any great number. Yet at the same time, there is a political arrangement with it. So I don't know. I think we're in a situation where you've just got to find a solution to this whole relationship between the historic amateur clubs and the professional regions. At the moment, this weird hybrid scenario it just all feels wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the best solution, if you've got three teams playing on a pitch, the best solution is the plastic surface. Mm. 4G or whatever. I don't know if that's allowed for football though.
I don't know, but certainly those hybrid pitches that they've got. When I say hybrid, now I'm referring to the hybrid pitch. But certainly they seem a lot more robust, don't they? The ones that
there's a they kind of use. This is something where I'm out of my field here because I'm not exactly sure, because they seem to use two different types of fake pitches or 4G pitches. A longer kind of blade of fake grass for rugby union than they do for soccer. I know my local, well, the club where I grew up, Canton RFC, have got a 4G pitch laid down for them for nothing, I think it was, by Cardiff City. But it's really short, blades of plastic grass or whatever the hell it's called, this 4G stuff, because they wanted it for soccer.
Yeah.
And then part of the deal was that Canton would get to use it as their first team pitch or whatever team plays on it. But when I've watched them play, because I know a couple of boys who play, they all got no skin left on their knees and what have you, because they're playing on this really, it's basically like, I don't know if you ever did it when you were a kid, trying to play rugby on old-fashioned AstroTurf that they still play hockey on.
Yeah. Like that sand-based stuff.
Yeah, well, they have big water hoses, they're not hoses, sprinkler systems all over it before the game to get the hockey ball to skim off properly, and then it's okay to fall on.
Yeah.
If you play five-a-side on it, and that would take a few layers of skin off. And this stuff that Canton RFC use is no different. So I what I'm getting at is, if they put a pitch in for rugby so that you could play the Dragons and Newport RFC as much as they wanted, would that still be suitable for Newport County? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a really good point. But yeah, I mean, look, the long and the short of it, and I'm not just talking about the blades of grass, is that you've got you've got to get a solution now. And obviously that, you know, there is an acrimonious relationship there, or it seems to be, and that's got to be worked on. And I do think that RFC deserve a bit of a favour for allowing the Dragons to carry on, and that needs to be addressed. But you know, if they, you can't carry on with a pitch like as it is, it's just a shambles for all of the teams. So I don't know. I hope that is addressed, and the whole relationship between the amateur clubs and the professional regions. Because really, if you're managing a professional region, you've got to be primarily concerned with that. But I don't know. It just doesn't seem to be a particularly good setup that they've got there at the moment. The pitch isn't good enough, and there clearly seems to be a bit of needle between the region and the club.
Yeah, I think there's, I might only be rumours at this stage, but I think there's changes afoot with Cardiff as well. I think the Blues are going to take over the running of the Cardiff RFC team.
Yeah, and there was a lot of rumours a couple of months ago that they were going to revert the name of the Blues back to Cardiff. And this isn't one to be wrapping up the podcast with. again, we're in a situation where these are the four sides that we've got, and you've just got to figure out a future that works for them. I miss the days where you had proper derbies between Newport and Cardiff, and that was at the top level of Welsh rugby, but it didn't work for the international side. And we've ended up with regions which, are they regions, are they not? I'm not entirely sure whether they are or not, but realistically, what
you mean, regions or super clubs?
Yeah, I think they are super clubs, aren't they, really? But you've kind of got to make it work, and there's no point kind of going, right, well, you know, Cardiff need to embrace Pontypridd a lot more or whatever. It's not going to happen, because from a playing perspective, they are half that Cardiff side are from Pontypridd or the surrounding areas.
Or Rhondda,
yeah. So, you know, and whether that's right or wrong, there's a commercial reality to it, and that's...
There's some massive tin of worms as you're opening at the end of the podcast.
I know, yeah. Well, there's
people, as you know as well as I do, there's people on Twitter who are still not happy with the regional setup, and they've been in that same mindset since 2003 when we switched.
I'm not sure I am. You know, it was never a clean break. No. It was never a clean break, and that's the problem.
I don't know what else could have happened. I think the argument of a lot of those people who are still banging that drum is their main issue is they haven't got a team in the valleys. That's their main issue, which I don't disagree with their point. But you have to realise that we couldn't go on as we were.
Yeah,
and this messy solution was the only solution we had.
Yeah, and we're 20 years down the line now. So do you try and do it again where you go, right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, anyone playing rugby now, Shane Lewis Hughes or anyone coming through, exactly. can't remember the old days anyway.
No, exactly, and that's the absolute reality of it, I think. And like I say, that's not right, but you've got to find a way that this. You've got to find a way that this works now, because there was some chat between David Buttress and someone else on Twitter this week about potentially rebranding again. I was like, well, what's the point? You know, what is the point? Are you ever going to fully appease Newport fans who didn't get on board? No, I don't think you will, unless you call the club Newport. And again, you know, is that going to do anything for Ebbw Vale fans and Pontypool fans who did embrace it? It's not. You know, all of this would go away if they were good sides, right? If the Dragons were getting to the Heineken Cup semi-final, no one would bloody care. Well, not no one, but a lot of people wouldn't care. And a lot of people who haven't gone to Pontypridd in a long time probably would.
They would be drowned out by the people celebrating anyway.
Exactly. And that's it. But
the main issue for me is that people are not as into rugby in Wales as the outside world thinks. They're into international rugby.
Yeah.
But when it comes to actually, you know, going out on a Friday night or whatever to watch a game in the rain or any adverse weather conditions, there's not that many people who actually want to go.
And maybe this is why. Maybe this is why, because the club set up, you know, the regional setup was never fit for purpose in terms of providing a flourishing club game. It doesn't help that you play in a league against Italian and South African sides. So, you know, there's loads wrong with it. But I think that the harsh reality is you need to find a way to make these things work. And if, again, like I say, if Dragons or Cardiff were better and people were, you know, and they were reaching European, you know, when Cardiff were really good at the Dai Young first time round, like you say, those voices kind of drowned out. But it's a really, really tricky one, and we haven't got time to do it now. But
it same goes to the Ospreys. When the Ospreys were the Galacticos, one was complaining. No one was complaining.
No, exactly. And I think that's the harsh reality of it. But I dare say we will be revisiting this at some point again soon. But next week we'll probably start to turn our attention towards the Six Nations. We have a Six Nations preview issue.
Talk about the squad again.
We'll talk about the squad again, which we've clearly enjoyed doing. A big thanks, Murph, for coming on again. Always good to have you on board. I'm sure we'll chat again during the Six Nations. And thanks, as always, to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to stock up on your coffee, you can do that at socoffeetrades.co.uk. But right now, thanks for listening. We'll be back to chat rugby with you very, very soon. Sports Social Podcast Network.